For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week we take a dystopian trip to the near future with partially cited author Fiona Scott Barrett. The former host of Woman's Hour, Jenny Murray, discusses her book A History of the World in 21 Women. And we meet the RNIB narrator who proves that there's life after death in The Archers. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Fiona Scott Barrett is a partially sighted author. After a career of writing educational books, she's turned her hand to fiction and just published her debut novel. The Exit Facility is a fast-paced dystopian thriller that explores issues around assisted dying, poverty, and visual impairment. She joined me from her home in Edinburgh to discuss her novel and some of the challenges of being a visually impaired author. Fiona, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Please, can you introduce us to The Exit Facility?
It's dystopian. It's set in the near future, but there are also elements of thriller and a lot of black humour in it. And the basic premise is that the state has introduced legal assisted dying, which could happen soon because there are consultations going on publicly, both in Scotland and at Westminster at the moment. And this is, of course, initially assisted dying for people who are terminally ill and in desperate pain. But the powers that be have thought it would be a good idea to extend this to anybody who actually wants an assisted death, as long as they are aged over 25 and they're not taxpayers. So the heroine, who is in her 60s and is partially sighted, has decided that she will take up this option. She's broke. She's got a flat left. But the next thing will be she'll have to sell that in order to live. And she doesn't want to do that because she has a daughter she hopes can inherit it. And so she signs herself into what they now call exit facilities. And then things start to get confusing and very dark because it's not what it claimed to be.
And your partially sighted heroine, Elaine, is going into this exit facility, as you say, because she has rather given up hope, but her own exit is delayed, and that gives her an opportunity to re-examine her reasons and gain insights into darker motivations that are actually causing a system really of eugenics.
Exactly. Yes, she discovers that it's not just the people who are terminally ill who obviously are benefiting from this, if it's their choice, or those who've chosen for whatever reason, but there are also a lot of homeless people who've been swept off the streets and taken there and never asked to go.
And she meets a wonderful character, Miss Latimer, who's a school teacher in her 90s, who thinks actually that she is in an old people's home.
That's correct. Yes, Miss Latimer has been put into what she thinks is a care home by her niece, and the niece has sold the idea to her as it being cheaper than some of the other care homes that are available. And this nice old lady, who is a little bit demented, also wants to have something to leave to her niece, her only living relative, and so accepts what she considers to be rather substandard service in order to not rip through her entire life savings and leave something for the niece. But she's utterly unaware of the fact that it is, in fact, an exit facility.
And Elaine is not the only character who has sight loss in the book. There's another character who has been put into this facility because her sight loss has been interpreted as a mental disability.
Exactly, yes. So this lady has severe sight loss and as a result of that suffers from Charles Bonnet syndrome, which causes visual hallucinations, and has been horribly exploited by both her GP and her lawyer, who've decided to send her off to an exit facility and basically get her out of the way.
The book really does raise these questions about whether some lives are more valuable than others, and whether we are ruled by governments that have a view of perfection. And it's a very disturbing, but as you say, a very plausible plot. Did you write it as a reaction to legislation that you feel may be coming in?
Partially, yes. I wrote it really in reaction to returning to Britain, having lived abroad for a very, very long time, and discovering that society was not what I imagined it to have been or to be in Britain. And I would read the papers every day and read appalling things about disabled people having their benefits cut and committing suicide or dying abandoned, unable to get to any kind of help, or about homeless people being removed from the streets in order to make Windsor look nicer for the last royal wedding. And I was just flabbergasted at what was going on. And I really, with the book, I think I just ramped up several situations that exist already and made them slightly more intense as a warning, maybe, or just out of shock at what I saw, that this country was not what I remembered in my rose-tinted spectacles view of things as it being when I left.
And I know that you already had a career in writing educational books. How difficult was it to turn those skills to writing fiction?
I wouldn't say it was that difficult, because a lot of the educational books I wrote were for teaching listening skills to non-native speakers of English. It's not solely that, but a lot of it was dialogue writing. So I would read articles on a specific topic, imagine people conversing on that topic or having a business meeting to discuss it, and wrap fact into what in a way was a fiction, but for the specific purpose of helping develop the skills of learners of English as a foreign language. So that was immensely useful when it came to writing The Exit Facility. What I didn't know much about was structuring and plotting a novel. So I actually went to a couple of creative writing courses that helped me with that. But definitely the educational writing fed into skills that I needed for fiction writing.
And I know that you too have a degenerative eye condition, which actually, having spoken to a lot of blind or partially sighted authors over the years, I think gives us a better ear for dialogue than most. But one of the other things that I've discovered is that it makes the physical task of writing a novel very challenging.
That's true, though I would say it wasn't as challenging for me as it would be for many other people. My condition is a very, very slow degeneration. I'm lucky that way. And with magnification, with a very large screen, I can see to write quite well. The difficult thing was editing, because you're looking back at a lot of text and going through it with a fine tooth comb, and then just eye strain on top of best disease made it very, very hard to do. So I actually got help with that.
I know that you had the launch for the book at the end of 2021, and you overcame the problem of having to do a reading yourself in a rather innovative way.
Yes, that's right. It had never occurred to me that actually the most difficult part of the entire process for me was going to be doing author readings while attempting to promote the book, because I can't read my own book. And 3 days before the launch, the special tablet that I used, that I should have been able to transfer the manuscript to so that I could read it, died on me. So I had a friend visiting for the launch. She and I had in the past been in amateur traumatic groups together. And I said, okay, you're going to read from the book certain parts, and I am going to memorize the heroine's responses, and we will do it as a quasi-dramatization. And it worked beautifully. And a lot of people said, oh, that was so much more dynamic, more interesting than the average normal reading.
And I know that the book is available through Amazon as a paperback and an ebook. Are there plans for an audiobook version?
I would very much like to do an audiobook version. I think it's not right to have a book about a partially sighted heroine that is not accessible to people who cannot read. It's a question of raising money to do an audio version at the moment. So I need lots of people to buy books so that I've got profits in order to invest in getting it made into an audiobook.
In the meantime, I know that you've recorded a couple of pages to give us a flavour of the book.
Moved and calmed by the beauty of the room, Elaine slipped into a pew, closed her eyes and bent her head. She addressed a silent prayer to she knew not whom or what. Behind her, the door opened and closed again, and footsteps approached. Elaine opened her eyes and saw a man carrying two polystyrene cups walk past her. He laid the cups on a pew diagonally opposite hers and sat down. Elaine couldn't restrain herself. "Excuse me," she said, "but I don't think you should bring hot drinks in here. The wood is so beautiful it would be a shame to stain it."
"I entirely agree," he said, "but these are not actually hot drinks."
His voice was mellifluous and vaguely familiar. The man stood up and moved towards her, his hand stretched out for shaking.
"Rupert Mortimer," he said. "Humanist celebrant. Haven't we met before?"
The navy blue silk cravat tucked into the neck of his pale pink shirt clinched it. "Yes, I'm Elaine," she said. "We met at a pre-closure party for two amazing women a couple of weeks ago."
Constantina Scott Barrett, narrating an extract from The Exit Facility, written by my guest, Fiona Scott Barrett.
And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Yes. Yes, it's the only way I read for pleasure anymore these days.
Are you a fan of a particular genre, or do you have broad tastes?
I have very broad tastes. I read quite a lot of non-fiction, and I also enjoy, I enjoy all sorts of things. A lot of what I read are things that I know of, because there's a very active writing scene in Edinburgh and, well, in Scotland in general. So you tend to know people who are writers, who know other writers. Say, oh, I'll try that one out, or I'll try this one out. So it's more on personal recommendation than by genre, I would say.
Fiona Scott Barrett, I wish The Exit Facility all the very best of luck, and I'm keeping my fingers firmly crossed that by the end of 2022, it's available as an audiobook. Please do stay in touch with the show, and thank you very much for taking us further into The Exit Facility.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Fiona will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
2020 absolutely knocked the stuffing out of me. Both physically and mentally, it was such a difficult year to navigate.
Looking after our mental well-being is more important than ever before.
I personally have found social distancing one of the hardest things. Keeping to a 2-metre rule has proven extremely difficult.
Need a safe space to talk? We're here for you.
Over the past months, we have spoken to hundreds of blind and partially sighted people who have been experiencing issues as a result of this pandemic.
Overnight, I lost my support system because I had to shield and my family had to shield.
It's understandable that many of us are feeling down and in need of a little extra emotional support at this time.
If you need to speak to somebody, book a mental well-being check-in. Visit rnib.org.uk/mental-well-being-check-in or call 0303 123 9999.
RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, narrator Becky Wright reveals why she was the natural choice to give voice to Joanna Toy's Shop Girl novels. But first, here's Ellie Marsh with another guest who's no stranger to the radio.
Hello, Jenny Murray, and welcome to Read On.
Hello. My favourite occupation, reading on.
Well, thank you so much for your time and thank you very much for joining us. So you've written several books through the course of your life, but we're here today and we're focusing on A History of the World in 21 Women, which I'll say now, for full disclosure, is one of my favourite books. I read it earlier on this year. My sister bought me it. And it's a fantastic book. Where did the idea come from in the first place for A History of the World in 21 Women?
Well, to be honest, my lovely publisher, who are the nicest publishers I've ever worked with, One World, they're called. And they approached me, and first of all, they said, would I write A History of Britain in 21 Women? Actually, at first, they said, would I do it in 18 women? And I thought, no, no, that's not enough. There are many more interesting women than just 18. He said, oh, all right, then you can have 21. So I did that one first, and then he came back to me and said, well, that's very good. You seem to have made a good job of that. It's doing very well. How about you extend it to the world? At which point I panicked because I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, that is a really big job, a history of the whole world in 21 women. And then I thought, well, no, hang on a minute. You know, who are the women over the years that I've learned about in history or I've just read about, or of course Woman's Hour introduced me to, and I thought, no, actually I can do that and it would be really interesting, because so often women have gone unrecognized for the extraordinary things that they have done. And then I wrote a list of the ones that had been my favorites, the ones that had really impressed me personally, and he totally approved of my list and said, yeah, go ahead, that'll be good.
Where did you start with that list? Because like you say, you know, working on Woman's Hour for that many years, I mean, it must have been as long as your arm, the original list. How do you sort of cut that down to 21?
Well, I started with Pharaoh Hatshepsut, which very few people know about. And the reason I knew about her so well is because some years ago, Woman's Hour decided it would be a really good idea to go and make a programme in Egypt. There were a lot of difficulties going on there with Islamic fundamentalism becoming much more popular. Women, did they have to wear a veil? Did they not have to wear a veil? They did make genital mutilation illegal, but we knew it was going on in small communities. And of course, it being Woman's Hour, we had to have a bit of the history of the country and at some of the food. We never, ever managed to make a programme anywhere without trying out some really good food. But the producer said, have you heard of this Pharaoh Hatshepsut? I couldn't even pronounce it at the time because it's not an easy name to pronounce. And I said, no, why? She said, well, it's a woman, you know, born a girl, who became the pharaoh, which was unheard of and was not allowed. Women could not be pharaohs. But what's extraordinary about her is that we flew down to where her temple is in the Valley of the Kings, as it's known. And there's an amazing temple there on which she had had engraved the life story that she completely made up, where you see her mother being approached by the god, and her then giving birth, and out of it comes a son. And she convinced the populace that actually she was really a boy, and she became the pharaoh. And she was an extraordinarily successful pharaoh. And then, of course, when she died, we think relatively young, the young man, her nephew, who inherited the position of pharaoh, did his very best to wipe her out of history.
But there's other women as well in the book that I personally hadn't heard of before, and whether that's to do with my age or just my ignorance, I'm not sure. But one woman that stood out to me from the book was Golda Meir. And Golda Meir and other women in the book, like you've just spoken of the Pharaoh, you've brought these women to a wider audience. Was that part of the process of deciding who you wanted to pick? Because there's really well-known women as well, you know, Frida Kahlo, Coco Chanel, people like that. But there's also these sort of lesser-known women. Was that important to you when you were setting out?
Wanted to get in there because I was actually in Israel around the time of the war and the problems that she was having. And of course, she was the first prime minister in Israel and was so tough and had come from a very, very difficult background when her family had managed to get from Russia and pogroms and those kind of things to come to Israel and get a really good education and then be, I think, probably one of the toughest women I've ever come across in my entire study of the history of women. She was just amazing. She never dressed herself up. She never tried to look anything other than a highly professional woman. And I loved her. I really admired her. She had a very, very difficult time in those pretty early years of Israel when the conflict was really boiling up. So she, I was very impressed by and kind of felt I knew her.
I just wanted to pick up on, in the book, you write about a couple of authors, female authors, and I'm just wondering about how important reading has been to you through your life.
Oh, incredibly important. I mean, well, I'm an only child. And sometimes that's an unlucky thing because, you know, you don't have siblings who you can play with. It tends to make you a bit over independent, I think. But the great benefit of it was that my mother's upwardly mobile intentions intended that her daughter should be absolutely brilliant at absolutely everything. And I remember her saying, you know, you could read by the age of two. And that's really ridiculous. I can't possibly have been able to read. She said, yes, you could. We had to buy you the children's newspaper to stop you reading the Daily Mail when you were 2 years old. Okay, fine. And then I was desperate to go to school. And of course, nobody would take you before you were five. My grandparents paid for me to go to the local convent school when I was four because I was so, so desperate to go to school and be with other children, really, because there weren't many children around where we lived. And so I think the book that really turned me on, and I know people will say, oh, you should be ashamed of that, but I'm not ashamed of loving Enid Blyton because I think she was the most brilliant children's writer. The one that turned me on was Shadow the Sheepdog. And I still have a copy of Shadow the Sheepdog. In fact, the original copy of Shadow the Sheepdog. Because, ever so, do you know, it's ridiculous. I am 71 years old. And every so often I go back to Shadow the Sheepdog. Because I loved dogs. The thing I wanted most when I was three or four was to have a dog. And the little boy in the book who has Shadow, who of course gets into all sorts of trouble, but then becomes the hero at the end of it. Shadow slept on his bed. And when my mother finally bought me for my fifth birthday, a little corgi cross called Taffy, all I wanted in life was to have Taffy lie on my bed like Shadow did. It was the one indulgence my mother completely denied me. She said, no way. She said, I don't mind you having a dog. I don't mind you walking a dog. But it's not sleeping on your bed.
What about your dogs now? Do they sleep on your bed?
I'm afraid they do.
You got your way in the end.
I did get my way in the end because, I mean, my husband and I have had separate rooms for as long as I can remember so that we both get a good night's sleep. And that he would not have put up with, frankly. But I can do it on my own. Of course, you know, my Butch, I had three Chihuahuas. And Butch, my eldest one, who was nearly 16, died this summer. So I miss him dreadfully. I can't tell you how much I miss him. But I've still got Frida and Madge. Frida named after Frida Kahlo, who is one of the women in the book. And Madge is named after Madonna, who is also in the book. And yes, they sleep in my bed very comfortably. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to pick up on Madonna as well, because she stood out to me in the book. And this is probably due to my age or maybe due to my musical tastes, but I didn't see Madonna as sort of a feminist icon until I read about her in the book. And then I did some research into her. And I'm a big fan of Michelle Visage, and she's a big Madonna fan. Why was she so important to you?
She was the first woman, all right, to behave in a way not all of us might have approved of. You know, she was highly sexualized, but a brilliant, brilliant performer. And I think the way she influenced women's feelings about their sexuality was really, really important. She opened up a lot. But most importantly, she had her own record label. She refused to take what so many women have suffered in the music industry, where, oh, you must look like this, oh, you must look like this, oh, you must sing this sort of thing, oh, you must behave like this. She just said, no, I will behave precisely the way I want to. Got her own record label, and other young women were able to really forge ahead in the music industry in the way they might not have done had she not led the way, really. All over the world, there is still a long way to go for women and girls. As Hillary Clinton, who has her own chapter in this book, said, women are the biggest untapped reservoir of talent in the world. In this collection of 21 of that reservoir, a tiny number when you trawl the entire globe, venture back in time and discover how many women have simply said no to the limits placed on their hopes and dreams, I have tried to include as wide a range of clever, talented, and determined women as possible. There must, I felt, be politicians, writers, artists, musicians, scientists, and athletes, and there must be women of different ethnic backgrounds. It's always necessary to emphasize that feminism and the fight for women's rights is not only the concern of white, middle-class women. Intersectionality, the somewhat awkward word coined in 1989 by an American professor, Kimberly Crenshaw, means certain groups of women have to navigate multiple layers of discrimination. For instance, a black woman may have to deal with both sexism and racism, and the feminist movement has to account for class, race, and gender when seeking to improve women's lives. I have to admit that the word intersectionality caused me one of the most embarrassing moments of my broadcasting career. I was interviewing Professor Crenshaw and asked her why she'd chosen such a difficult word to introduce what is, in effect, a pretty obvious concept. What exactly did it mean? Well, she said, it's a crossroads. It's where these problems of race, class, and gender intersect. Of course, I mumbled, blushing. We are indeed two nations divided by a common language.
And if you had to pick one woman from this book, I mean, you've probably been asked this 100 times, but which woman out of the 21 would you say you'd have to go for?
Anna Politkovskaya. She was a Russian journalist, and obviously also being a journalist, I understood very well what she was trying to do. She was the first to really recognise how dangerous Putin was. And of course, they wouldn't publish her books in Russia. But where she really made an impression was she was very busy with her journalism during the Chechen War. And she really wanted to get to know things from the Chechen side. And she got to know a lot of the Chechen leaders, which was a dangerous thing for any journalist to do. And then when there was a terrorist attack in a theatre in Moscow, and it was expected that, you know, the audience were going to be killed by Chechen so-called terrorists, she determined that she would go in and negotiate with the terrorists, which she did. And she saved a lot of lives in that circumstance. And then again, when the same people attacked the school that was so famous and so horrible, you know, taking over a school with tiny little children in it who were all absolutely terrified, she said that she would go down there. But she got on the plane, and the next thing she knew was she was in hospital in a state of collapse. So clearly what she'd been doing was discovered, and she reckons it was in a cup of tea, you know, which now we know is not uncommon. She did come round from what she was absolutely convinced was poisoning. She wrote a big book about Putin and all these things that she'd been up to, saying, you know, we must speak truth to power. She came over here. I interviewed her. We sat in front of each other. And I was so impressed by her. She really knew what her job as a journalist was. It was to speak truth to power. And not long afterwards, we heard that she had gone out shopping. She'd come back with lots of bags of food and whatever she'd been shopping for in her flat in Moscow, which was on one of the higher floors. So she had to get into the lift. She couldn't get all her shopping into the lift. She went up, having left some of the shopping down outside the lift on the ground floor. She came down and she was shot point blank range and was killed. And I just look back on that and think, would I, in that dangerous atmosphere where journalists were being killed in Russia, would I have had the courage to do what she did and put my life at risk to bring out really important stories and, as I said, speak truth to power? And I'm not convinced I would.
That is an extremely powerful story. I mean, what do you want people to take away from the book, whatever their gender might be? I mean, themes in the book, like you say, are courage and bravery. But what do you want people to take away from this book?
I don't like the word gender. It's being very much abused these days. I talk about sex, because sex and gender are different, obviously. You know, your sex is what you were born with, and your gender is how you decide to present yourself. And this book, I know one of them was a woman who passed herself off as a man. But for me, I just want people to take away from this book how much women who are born women, how much courage they have often displayed, and how much intelligence and capability and just bravery they have faced in order to really make an impact on the world.
Jenny Murray, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Ellie. And A History of the World in 21 Women, written and narrated by Jenny Murray, is available from the RNIB Library, alongside Jenny's autobiography and a retrospective of 50 years of Woman's Hour.
Hello everyone, my name's Paul and I'd like to recommend a book to you. It's called Erebus, The Story of a Ship, and it's by Michael Palin. And it's all about the ship HMS Erebus, which I'd not heard of before I actually listened to this book. And the ship was launched in 1826. It went on voyages of the Antarctic, and it did some of the early scientific discoveries of the Great Southern Barrier Reef, rather. And It talks not only about the ship itself, but also the crew members. So the original captain, James Clark, and how he chartered most of that great southern reef. And then the fated John Franklin, the 60-year-old captain of that fatal final voyage. And the reason I enjoyed this book was a lot to do with Michael Paling reading it, because obviously he made it so exciting and interesting. And as I said, I didn't know anything about this ship before I listened to this book. So I learnt a great deal, which is always good. I think it's always lovely to learn something new every day, and even better if it comes from books. Now, I actually only started listening to Talking Books during lockdown, because I found that obviously the libraries were closed, bookshops were closed, or when they were open, you couldn't go and browse, you couldn't take books off the shelf, otherwise the books then spent the next 72 hours on the naughty step. So I was listening to a lot of audiobooks. And the reason I hadn't listened to them before was because my mind wanders. I don't particularly have a very good concentration span. So I often used to start a book and then my mind had gone on to other things, and I found that I was constantly rewinding, thinking, oh, what's this about now? And I've lost the train of thought, or I've lost the sort of plot. So so I just thought, oh, this is ridiculous, you know, and then just sort of left them alone. But they were really, really good friends within lockdown. And I think we're very, very lucky to have this service and so many other providers of these services, which are currently free, which makes such a difference. So I would simply say to you, if you can get a chance to listen to Erebus, the story of a ship by Michael Palin, please do. And I hope it teaches you something and keeps you entertained during the darker hours that are coming up through winter.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Fiona Scott-Barrett to share the books of her life, as regular listeners will know, over the past few years, we've been following the fortunes of Joanna Toy's Shop Girls as they battle the privations of World War II and the schemes of black marketeers to keep the department store at the centre of their community running. With the final book in the series due for publication in spring, I thought it was high time to catch up with the narrator who's brought the series to life in audio, sometimes under conditions reminiscent of the Blitz. Like Joanna Toy, Becky Wright spent many years working on the long-running BBC radio soap opera The Archers. However, soon after Joanna left to pursue her literary career, Becky's character, Nick Grundy, was killed off by sepsis. Fortunately for us, Becky lives on as an audiobook narrator and now gets to play the whole cast in Joanna's books. Becky Wright, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here, albeit remotely.
Such are the days that we live in.
Indeed. When it works, it works. When it doesn't, it's awful.
Now, in addition to knowing Joe through The Archers, I know that you were especially keen to work on the Shop Girls series for personal reasons.
Yeah, I kind of inherited the series, actually, because I'm from the area. And when Joe told me about what it was about, a lot of the places mentioned in the book are places that I spent time in as a child. And also one of the places that, or one of the shop in the book is inspired by, my great auntie used to work at. So it's not the actual branch, because I think Joe based it out of Wolverhampton, but my great auntie used to work at the Solihull branch of Beatty's back in the day. So yeah, there's kind of a little connection around there. And also my family are sort of mainly from Birmingham, actually, because the Shop Girls books are set in a fictional town called Hinton. So it's based on a number of places that I know, I believe.
And so you must have visited those old Edwardian emporiums as a young girl and had vestiges of that 1940s starched prim and properness.
Yeah, I think the department store is a very British national treasure, isn't it? I remember going to like Santa's Grotto when I was really small, like 3 or 4 years old, at what used to be Lewis's in Birmingham. And I remember going to Rackham's, but it was always a bit of an occasion to go. You know, you go if you needed school shoes, or you go to the Poncy Cafe or something. So it was always a bit of an event. But I miss those places, and they're all dying now, aren't they? I mean, Debenhams went recently, I think, and has all gone online. But they're very unique, and I think they are, you know, very much of their time in quite a wonderful way.
And I think that's why the Shop Girls series has really captured the imagination, because it is recent history remembered.
Yeah, and it's a time that we've lived through. Like, some of those buildings haven't changed. I mean, they have refits and stuff, but they're essentially the same buildings that, you know, that were around in World War II and before. So in my lifetime, I've been in those buildings, and it's still very current. And also, it's happened in, certainly, I mean, my grandparents aren't around anymore, but they just could be, I think, if they'd probably be in the 90s now. But it's very real. You know, we have that heritage around us. It's not that far removed from today. And there's those little pockets of things and those things that are oh so familiar. And certainly when I read the books, I can picture very clearly the world that Jo's created. Very, very clearly.
And they were communities, and the customers were part of that community. And that means that you have an enormous range of voices to play through.
Yeah. I think there's a thing with audiobooks. You kind of get ones that are very narrative and sort of almost lyrical in the prose and the worlds they create. And other ones are about the people. So it's like doing an 8-9 hour monologue of all these different people. And, you know, Jo's books, Jo wanted them narrated in a kind of performative way so that these people really lived and you had an idea about what they were like and where they came from. And, you know, because she's written a series, it's bringing them to life over a period of time. So, you know, they grow and develop, and hopefully that's enjoyable to listen to, I hope.
And so you actually get to be an entire theatre cast of characters.
I did say to Jo, because he had a little chat with me before I did, I can't remember which one of them it was, and we were talking about voices. She said, oh, I think so-and-so should sound like this. And I said, well, I've got five people already sounding like that with that accent. I said, sure, how many characters are there? I think we counted there were 72 people, including the incidentals at one point. You know, just the people it alluded to of all these different people she brought to life. But yeah, sometimes it does feel like a cast of thousands in your head. And sometimes I will stop recording going, who am I? Okay. Because I always have like a list at the side of reference points in case I forget entirely where I am.
And even within a single character, you have to modulate your voice, because Lily has her shop voice, but she also has her home voice.
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted with Lily was that she gradually kind of loses that accent, that it comes out at home more. So when she's talking to Dora, you know, little bits come out. And then when she's at work, also because Jim's got a slight accent, they're both people from different communities, but you know, you have people in the shop that are very well spoken and BBC English. And I had again talking to Jo about that, and Jo said, you know, well, I think eventually Lily would have a cut glass accent. And I argued against it, because I said, well, she's lived in that area her whole life, and also all of her social life is around that too, and they encourage the men and women to, you know, speak properly. So I kind of wanted to take the edge off her very, very, very slowly. But of course, when she's upset, when she's with her mum, and when she's with her friends, when she's with Beryl, who's very broad, I try to give her that life of being somebody who does adapt to her circumstances. But yeah, that was kind of my aim. And as she matured, her voice did too.
And do you have a favourite character voice from the series?
Ooh, I rather like Gladys. I think Gladys is rather sweet. I just like the character. And I liked Phyllis the Scouser, who came in and basically whipped everybody into shape in the last one. I was like, I like her, she can stay. I really like those really broad accents, you know, like Beryl and Dora as well, because that's how my family sounds. That's very familiar to me. And I think it's also, it's not an accent you hear very much in entertainment or on the telly. It's one people shy away from because of various, you know, prejudices about it. But I think it's rather beautiful. But yeah, it's a big comfort to me. So any of the broader accents remind me of my family.
And of course, one thing that you couldn't have known at the beginning of all of this is that you too were going to have to hide in your bunker at home.
Oh, God.
Keep calm and carry on.
Do you know what? I'm not going to lie. It was a nightmare. I'm really not going to lie about it. People think it's really simple, do you? I mean, I find, even though I do a lot of them, of all the things I do, I find audiobooks the hardest because it is just you. And if you take that and when, because I was doing, I think it was wartime. Yeah, it was wartime for the shop girls in wartime conditions, just as the first lockdown happened. And I literally was asked, do you have a microphone? And I was like, sorry, what? Do you have a And so I cobbled something together, but also I live in a terraced house with lots of noise going on. And it's very hard every time somebody slams a door, every time somebody turns on a tap, every time somebody is living their life. It ruins your take. And I also had some tech problems because I had a very old laptop. And I actually recorded one of the chapters in wartime 7 times. I actually shudder thinking about it. But yeah, it wasn't ideal. It was nobody's fault. It was just the way it worked out. But I had flashbacks over that for a while. And I kind of got to one point, I went, I'm never doing an audiobook again. This is it. I'm never doing it again. But yeah, I think what people don't realise is, you know, people think, oh, you know, do you just turn up and read it? I often get asked, you know, do you read the book beforehand? Or do you just turn up in page one? And I was like, if only you knew. The trick is to make it sound easy. And it's not. It's really hard. And I'm not going to be smug and say I find it easy because I really don't. And I've been doing it a long time.
Well, yes. And apart from being a very much in-demand narrator for talking books, you, I know, also have a link to Sight Loss because you are a support worker for a visually impaired writer.
Yeah, very recently so, actually. A friend of mine approached me late last year. She's a screenwriter, quite a successful one, and has got to a point in her life where she feels she needs support, but also didn't want to approach a stranger. And yeah, my friend's very bright, very interesting, very funny, and we're having a great laugh, and I keep screwing things up. But we're getting through it, you know. So I read her scripts and stuff, and I read her treatments and things for the TV show she works on. And so I have to sign NDAs and stuff. But it is very funny. And I do sit and voice everything just for laughs, because we think it's amusing. But yeah, I am. And I'm really enjoying it, actually. It's a great insight, excuse the pun. You know, it's a great insight into how someone else copes with the world with the condition that she has.
And must make you appreciate even more just how important audiobooks, talking books are to those of us who have lost our sight.
Oh, completely, because it's building worlds and it's also giving people an access to a creative life in a way. And yeah, so I completely get it.
Well, for you, the war is nearly over. Just one more book in the Shop Girls series.
Yep.
And hopefully you'll be back in an independent studio rather than your home studio soon.
I've actually been, the last two books were recorded in a studio, so we managed to get around that because audiobooks have been quite good because it's just you and your producer's the other side of the glass. So I have on the last two been in, but yeah, I only had to do the one at home. So I'm very grateful. I'm very, very grateful to be back in.
Well, Becky Wright, thank you so much for giving us some more insight into the world of being a talking book narrator and for being a guest on the show today.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Becky Wright. All of Joanna Toy's Shop Girls novels are available from the RNIB Library. And you can find a full list of books that Becky Wright has narrated by visiting rniblibrary.com or calling the helpline on 0303 123 99. Double nine. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
The RNIB is committed to providing life-changing support and specialist services. Services that we know people affected by sight loss need now more than ever. But we need your help. The coronavirus outbreak represents an unprecedented situation for all of us. For RNIB, it's having a huge impact on our ability to raise the money we need to continue vital services at a time when so many of us are feeling isolated and anxious. The need for access to information and to feel socially connected is critical for all of us. With an increase in demand, we're working hard to keep vital services running so that blind and partially sighted people don't have to face this crisis alone. But we need your help. This is a time for community and coming together, and we need your support now more than ever. Please help RNIB today to support the 2 million people in the UK with sight loss, their friends, family and carers. Donate at 0330 002 0893 or use the website rnib.org.uk/urgent appeal. Thank you.
Now it's back to Fiona Scott-Barrett for the books of her life.
Fiona, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
As a youngster, I had very eclectic tastes. But when I got to being a teenager, I was very serious in those days, and I absolutely adored Animal Farm, and then went on from there to 1984. So I think I've had an interest in dystopian literature since that early age. And I revisited Animal Farm of George Orwell lately and was astonished at how good it still is. I mean, it appealed to me when I was about 12 as a child. And then I reread it maybe 5 or 6 years ago and thought, this book works on so many levels. It is really amazing.
It had happened at last. The expected message had come. All his life, it seemed to him, he had been waiting for this to happen. He was walking down the long corridor at the ministry, and he was almost at the spot where Julia had slipped the note into his hand, when he became aware that someone larger than himself was walking just behind him. The person, whoever it was, gave a small cough, evidently as a prelude to speaking. Winston stopped abruptly and turned. It was O'Brien. At last, they were face to face. And it seemed that his only impulse was to run away. His heart pounded violently. He would have been incapable of speaking. O'Brien, however, had continued forward in the same movement, laying a friendly hand for a moment on Winston's arm, so that the two of them were walking side by side. He began speaking with the peculiar grave courtesy that differentiated him from the majority of inner party members.
"I had been hoping for an opportunity of talking to you," he said. "I was reading one of your Newspeak articles in the Times the other day. You take a scholarly interest in Newspeak, I believe?"
Gordon Griffin, narrating 1984 by George Orwell, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, I am a huge fan of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which again, not dystopian, but it is science fiction, has a lot of humour in it. Also a bit of tragedy and a lot of philosophy. So I love the fact that it brings in all these different aspects. It never fails to entertain. I've probably read all 5 volumes of it 6, 7, 8 times throughout my life. And it always gives pleasure when I go back to it.
Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd because on the whole it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches.
Gordon Gilliou, narrating The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, a book that I have really enjoyed and read quite recently is a non-fiction book called Entangled Life, and it's by Merlin Sheldrake. And it is the story of fungi and how there is a huge web of information flowing about underneath our feet that is transmitted through what is known as the wood wide web. And that is a huge network of fungi that interconnect with each other. It's still not absolutely certain what means they use to send messages, but there are all these messages flowing about from place to place, interconnecting with trees, and absolutely amazing. And it is also exquisitely narrated by the author. So it's a pleasure to listen to, and the ideas in it, and the science, and the potential that the book offers for new medicines, new products, things that would be more sustainable using lessons learned from fungi or fungi themselves, is absolutely inspirational. So I would recommend that very highly.
Fungi are everywhere, but they're easy to miss. They're inside you and around you. They sustain you and all that you depend on. As you hear these words, fungi are changing the way that life happens, as they have done for more than a billion years. They are eating rock, making soil, digesting pollutants, nourishing and killing plants, surviving in space, inducing visions, producing food, making medicines, manipulating animal behavior, and influencing the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. Fungi provide a key to understanding the planet on which we live and the ways that we think, feel, and behave. Yet they live their lives largely hidden from view, and over 90% of their species remain undocumented. The more we learn about fungi, the less makes sense without them.
Merlin Sheldrake, narrating his book Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Fiona Scott-Barrett, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.